You're listening to WRT 89.9 FM, Madison.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. An aid agency in Sudan has told the BBC that many people fleeing the paramilitary RSF have died from starvation or thirst in temperatures exceeding 40 degrees Celsius. The Norwegian Refugee Council has described the horrific conditions in the town of Tawila in the North Darfur region as more than 100,000 people flee fighting in the area. Here's our Africa regional editor, Will Ross.
In the west of the country, the vast Darfur region, the war is, it looks as though it's getting worse. In recent days, there's been this ongoing attempt by the RSF to capture El Fasher, and they've also pushed people out of the camps, Zamzam and Abu Shuk, camps close to El Fasher. So their effort really is to get the people out and to gain control of these areas. And it seems they don't care what happens to the people, and that's why they're going through such hardships.
A senior Russian general has been killed in an explosion near his home in a Moscow suburb. Reports suggest he was walking past a parked car when an explosive device inside was detonated. No one has so far said they carried out the attack. Vitaly Shevchenko reports.
General Yaroslav Moskalik was deputy head of the main operational department at the Russian General Staff. Back in 2015, he was involved in talks with Ukraine held in Paris. This morning, he was killed as a car exploded outside a residential tower block in the Russian capital's eastern suburb of Balashikha. This is the latest in a series of assassinations targeting officials and pro-war figures inside Russia since the start of the invasion of Ukraine. Ukrainian security services have never officially acknowledged their involvement in such attacks, but it's clear that they would be interested in them.
The US envoy Steve Witkoff has been holding talks in Moscow with President Putin on how to end the war in Ukraine. Donald Trump has claimed the two sides are close to reaching a deal, but this is thought to require Ukraine giving up large areas of territory, something that President Zelensky has repeatedly rejected. Pakistan's Senate has rejected India's accusations that Pakistan was linked to an attack which killed 26 people in Indian-administered Kashmir on Tuesday. India says two of the four attackers were Pakistani. In a unanimous resolution, the Senate said Delhi's allegations were meant to malign Islamabad. Pakistan's Foreign Minister Ishaq Dar called it a smear campaign.
The Senate of Pakistan condemns the orchestrated and malafide campaign by the Indian government to malign Pakistan, which follows a familiar pattern of exploiting the issue of terrorism for a narrow political gain.
India has suspended a critical water-sharing agreement with its neighbour. World News from the BBC.
Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and co-workers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Children's Theater of Madison, presenting The Trials, May 2nd through 11th in the Starlight Theater at the Madison Youth Arts Center at 1055 East Mifflin Street. The Trials addresses the climate emergency and intergenerational conflict. The play is intended to spark discussion and debate about climate change, responsibility, and accountability. Recommended for ages 13 and up. Tickets and information at ctmtheater.org.
Thank you. It's a Friday, 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore. It's April 25. Beautiful bike ride, Ann. I was worried because, you know, it was raining an hour ago, and then it stopped. Then all these beautiful blue sky colors. Jim Wilson, I was number 53. I do want to ask you about something. I was number 53 at the bike path. I checked this week. I'm not going to put you on the spot, see if you did.
Perfect.
But I do want to ask you a bike question. Jim is our, as you know, resident bike genius. So I passed two, not one, but two, parents, two different parents pedaling one of those giant cargo electric bikes, you know, with the canoe on the front, with, you know, with a couple of preschoolers up there. Those friggin' things must cost $36,000. How much does one of those bad boys cost?
Ooh, good question.
About?
I think it's less than $36,000, but I think it is in the range of like 10 to 12.
You could actually buy a previously owned, or what is that, owned a car for the same price as one of those, couldn't you?
About, yeah.
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 Yeah. I this is going to sound more bitter than I want, but I picture those young parents driving those, pedaling those to the Smash the Rich protest. I'm just, that's not nice. I'm glad they have those. They're pretty spiffy. If I could afford one back when I had toddlers, I'd probably get one. No, we would probably use that money for a car.
Plus, but a couple other bonuses that you have to think about is you don't have to pay for gas for them.
That's,
you know, you're
right,
paying whatever your electricity is for charging them, but then you also don't have to, you know, not as much for maintenance. You also don't need to insure them, but a lot of people probably just have it under their home insurance, but also then you never get stuck in traffic.
Jim Wilson gets a commission on every one of those big old bikes. Thank you, Jim, as always. And also for your glass half full. You keep me honest on that. Listen, folks, the WRT family, Jim and Ankur, the rest of us, Elliot, got some big news this week. Sad news, but exciting news. That seems to always be the combination when a longtime colleague announces that they're moving on to other career opportunities. And I'm talking about WRT's talented and tireless news and talk director, Charlie Pittman. Charlie let everyone know this week that she's taking on a new opportunity, still in journalism, and fortunately, still in this market. I'm going to say a lot of good things about her right now, because next week she's agreed to join us on the Friday Buzz for an exit interview. And I won't want to say great things about her then, because, you know, her enormous ego. Actually, she's most likely listening right now, because that's what she does. She keeps an ear on this place, and there's very few things that go out over the WRT airwaves that she doesn't hear or beforehand look over and make better. Folks, this is a volunteer place, and you know that. And if you think it's easy leading an almost entirely volunteer staff, you've never tried it, because we're a wily bunch, wouldn't you say, Jim? But there's nothing that Charlie won't do to help a volunteer succeed here. Charlie's the one, and please don't hold it against her, who got me going on this show. I like to think that I sound like I know what I'm doing on the air, you know, here on Friday mornings. But I didn't really know my way around radio at all until I got here. So I got to experience Charlie's training and her orientation firsthand. And you can stop a comment or a question before it goes on the air, but you can never retrieve it once it does. And walking that line, it defines credibility as a sounding board. And in this context, Charlie has been an invaluable partner to me and to this program. And we'll ask Charlie next week when she's here about the specifics of her next gig. But I can't imagine her working any more hours than she does here or being any more devoted to the mission. And we'll miss you, Charlie. And that's the last nice thing I'm going to say about you. Until next week. What about this week? We have, let's see, Jim. They called right before air, and they say the call will come at about 8:45.
Yeah, that's right. It's changed a few times.
Well, not only that, we were in telephone conferencing last night. They had asked for a pre-record last night, which we occasionally do, especially for people who are important and busy, then this guest certainly qualifies. And then they called again and said they needed to do it live this morning. We're aiming at 8:45. The they I'm talking about are the press staffers for U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And indeed, Secretary Kennedy is scheduled to join us at about 8:45 a.m. So stay with us for that. But first up, we'll hear from a UW professor who, for want of a better description, just had the federal grant rug pulled out from under his research. And at half past the hour, we'll meet the owners of Baldwin's Books and Records, a new Madison pop-up specializing in Black, trans, women's literature and record albums. That will be fun. Good morning to Engineer Without Peer, Jim Wilson, from whom we just heard. Hello to Friday Buzz musical director Encore Malhotra, otherwise known as DJ Spin Cycle. And howdy out front to Elliot LeBrun, our online producer. It's the Charlie Pittman edition of the Friday Buzz. Let's get buzzing. Friday 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore. That was the Brazilian version, if I got that correctly, Encore, of the theme from The Godfather. And what would this country be without the cultural contributions from other countries? Okay, segment one. They call them priorities. That's a nice, sane-sounding word for what has become a Trump administration axe to federal grants that fund university research, ranging from cancer studies to childhood development. More than $12 million in research grants from the National Institutes of Health alone, destined for the UW-Madison, have been cut by the administration, leading to a lawsuit filed by Wisconsin and 15 other states. Democratic State Attorney General Josh Call says the administration is, quote, sabotaging medical and public health research, unquote. Meanwhile, over in Vilas Hall, the National Science Foundation, otherwise known as NSF, eliminated a $5 million grant that supported the School of Journalism's ongoing project that aims to amplify accurate claims about vaccine, something we'll be asking RFK Jr. about later in this hour. In the wake of the recent cut, project leader Professor Mike Wagner said, quote, the federal government now explicitly says that understanding the verifiable truth is not a priority, unquote. Professor Wagner joins us now by phone. Good morning, Professor Wagner, and welcome back to the Friday Buzz.
Hey, Eddie.
How did you get the news of the grant being eliminated?
We received an email from our vice chancellor for research's office. They received an email from the NSF letting them and us know that the grant was terminated on Friday. And so all spending, that we would have to do, all grant work that we would have to do that came after Friday, we couldn't use the grant to do any more of that work.
Mike, this comes in the wake of already a lot of research and work done. And this is a little bit of a cheesy question, but I've got to ask you, what did that feel like when you read that?
Well, I mean, on the one hand, we knew this was going to happen. And so, we'd been living with the sword of Damocles over our head for a few months now. And so it wasn't that we couldn't believe it. We'd already gone through the stages of, I can't believe the government is going to say that a grant that had been, vetted blind by a number of other scientists who we didn't know who they were, you know, reviewed our proposal to make sure it was scientifically sound, that the NSF itself, you know, thought that the project was sound. We had actually gone through an earlier phase, so we'd already proved ourselves to the NSF to get the phase two grant in the first place. And so it's just kind of amazing that, you know, in the United States of America, the federal government is telling you, one, the verifiable truth is no longer a priority to us, and two, the work that you're doing is terminated, not because the work isn't good or there's a problem with it, but because we no longer have a priority to fight misinformation.
Let's stay on that path. I understand that along with the $5 million cut to your project, that the NSF eliminated what you say is tens of millions of dollars of grants studying ways to mitigate the spread of false information.
Yep.
What are some other examples of projects of this sort?
A lot of projects involve partnerships with local community organizations to help these groups communicate what they're doing, but also to help groups develop kind of media literacy skills so that they're not swayed by, you know, false stuff that they see online. There's another project that seeks to kind of protect experts so that when they're sharing things that they know are true and share, like, here's the transparent evidence that we have and often face attacks, how do you help protect people who might be journalists, who might be scientists, who might be public health officials? There are other projects that are related to, that were related to trying to help social media platforms do their fact checking. And, you know, when a post is getting a lot of attention and has the virtue of being false, how to, like, append that post with, you know, the person has the right to say this, but here's what we know is true, and here's a link to that evidence, you know. So instead of, like, pulling down the content or deplatforming a person, spreading misinformation, just trying to find ways to say, they have the right to say this thing, but here's stuff where there's evidence behind it.
I think of all the work that could be done with that time and money doing real work rather than work to let people know the importance of what's unreal.
Yeah, you know, I think it was something that, you know, I mean, as a mass communication scholar with a degree in political science, I'm not surprised that, you know, people struggle to accept things that are true when they don't like them for different political reasons. But for a lot of scientists on our campus and around the globe, it's been a real wake-up call over the last 5 years where people who were, like, in vaccine development would say to me, we developed a vaccine, we tested it in randomized control trials, we know it works. We've told people the truth. Why don't they accept it?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a whole field, of course, of science communication that talks about how to credibly communicate information and why people are skeptical of science at times. And so it's just been, you know, I think enormously frustrating for researchers and frightening for researchers, especially those who maybe aren't from the U.S. to begin with. A lot of our graduate students are international students. Many of my colleagues, you know, were born in another country and wanted to come here and work in the premier, you know, university system in the world. And so there's just all kinds of things kind of happening at once that make it really hard to do the work.
Go into a little more detail about your project, the one affected here at UW-Madison. What was it doing? It was horrible to talk about it in the past tense. Strange.
Well, I mean, we're still doing the work. We're just not getting any government.
Okay.
We're not getting the dollars we thought we had to spend on it, but which of course will affect what we can do and how we do it. But our project, you know, we're big believers in the marketplace of ideas and that people's ideas ought to be able to compete. And so our project is not one that seeks to deplatform people. There's lots of good reasons to take people's accounts offline if they're spreading things that aren't true or dangerous or things, but our project didn't do that. Our project said, okay, we want to be able to use kind of computational social science techniques to identify what are some topics where people are sharing lots of stuff that at least it might not be true. But once we identify those networks, like here's stuff being shared about the HPV vaccine, or here's stuff being shared about the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, or what have you. And we think it might not be true because they're not linking to credible evidence, or they're using really emotional language that people tend not to use when, you know, sharing facts. And so we want to first look there. Then we want to see if independent fact checkers and independent scientists different than us all agree on what the verifiable truth is. And if they do, then we want to figure out how do we pump information that is verifiably true into the networks that saw the stuff that's false. So how can we do that? So what one plan that we had was to use the advertising features on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and just say, we want to advertise to these accounts because we think these accounts have seen stuff that isn't true. So we want to pay for it. We don't want to do what we want to do is just show people things that are true, and then we want to see if they become more likely to believe things that are true or not. Do they become more likely to engage in behaviors that reflect that? And so that was really the goal of our grant.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Mike Wagner. He's the director of the Center for Communication and Civic Renewal in the UW School of Journalism. Listening carefully to what you said, Mike, is there a sort of a echo chamber danger by identifying false sources?
Echo chamber danger in terms of
here's what's not true, but all of a sudden you've echoed what they're saying is not true.
Oh, I see. Sure. So yeah, there's part of our grant was to rigorously test in carefully controlled experiments what kinds of messages are helpful to correct things. Like, because just saying here's something that's true doesn't always work, or saying here's a false claim and this is the true one, that also doesn't work very well because, as you say, it kind of also amplifies the false claim. And so we rigorously tested different kinds of strategies to see how well they work, and strategies that use what we call a truth sandwich. So here's the truth, here's something that you might have seen online that isn't true, but here's the truth. And doing that while also sharing visual evidence of the truth, a seeing is believing kind of strategy. Those things together seem to work really well. And then we tried lots of other variants of like, well, what kind of visual? Should there be people in the visual? Should there be graphics in the video? You know, and so we're trying all these really, you know, really narrow kinds of strategies, but to prevent the very thing you're talking about, which is making things worse by trying to make things better. Yeah.
I understand better now. Not only these things together, but these things in this order, it all of that matters, right. It sounds like. I mentioned that your project was notified of the grant elimination, and you mentioned it too under an NSF notice that said the project wasn't meeting the foundation's priorities. Many people are now generally aware in the true communication realm that these grants are being eliminated, but very few people have read notices of this sort. So pull back the curtain for our listeners, if you would, Professor Wagner. How are current priorities identified? How are current NSF priorities identified by the foundation?
That is a complete black box. When we got our notice that said your project and misinformation studies more generally don't meet NSF priorities, it didn't come with a, and here's what our priorities are, kind of message as well. And so it's completely unclear as to what they are. I mean, the NSF director resigned this week. I think a lot of people are very curious about what the priorities are of the National Science Foundation and the other government agencies that do critical research to advance healthcare infrastructure, public safety, digital security, all those sorts of things.
Mike, what is the line between stifling free speech and stifling research?
Oh, that's a great question. I'll admit I don't know the answer. I think that it's the best thing that scientists can do, I think, is to say, here's what we know, here's how we know it, here's how much of a consensus there is around what we think we know. And the better the evidence and the greater the consensus, the more confident we should be in that particular claim. And lots of things we learn iteratively over time, lots of things we learn that thing might have been true, but for a different reason than we thought. And you know, the scientific process is just really frustrating, and it's mostly failure, right? It's mostly learning what doesn't work. Like, as Edison said, you know, I learned 100 and some ways to not make a light bulb, right, before he made a light bulb, right? And so the process is really slow and frustrating. But social media especially is, here's a quick claim with tons of confidence behind it. And when even and scientists sometimes get into this too, where they'll overstate the generalizability of something they've discovered, or they communicate their finding without the important caveat that's in their scientific paper but not in their public communication about it. And so there are things scientists can do better as well. But, you know, I think it's really difficult to figure out what's the line between what's our right, you know. I mean, I guess we'll fall back on when it puts someone else in danger, you know, that's probably a pretty good reason to restrict it, right?
And that protracted process you just described must be why it's called research instead of search. I don't know. Just a guess.
I like that. I'm going to use that.
Good. Okay, fair enough. But make sure you give attribution. Professor.
Well, you know, fake news. I didn't even hear you say it, to be honest. So, I'm just kidding. Of course.
Okay.
Of course, I would attribute.
Thank you.
That's the absolute right thing.
Listener, so we are talking to the real Mike Wagner. He's really the director of the Center for Communication and Civic Renewal at the real UW-Madison School of Journalism. Mike, this is a bit of a clumsy comparison, but if, and I should say when, PBS and NPR lose federal funding, they'll turn to more, hopefully, user support and state support for those services. Where do academics turn?
That's a good question. Mostly to foundations. And so there are lots of private foundations that fund work, but they don't, and they can't fund it at the scale that the federal government does. There are people who are interested in curing Alzheimer's, finding successful treatments and cures for cancer, finding new mental health strategies, finding better ways to teach kids math. But the foundations are a drop in the bucket compared to the resources of the federal government. And so, you know, all of us are not going to go to the same five foundations that fund stuff in whatever our area is. And now they'll be overwhelmed with all these folks who've, you know, lost their resources to do the work they're trying to do. And then they'll have to figure out, you know, how they want to prioritize those kinds of things. And they'll have to figure out, do they want to stick their necks out when a government is actively hostile to that research agenda? These are all big foundations with big endowments. And if the government is going to weaponize how they treat people who study these things, those foundations might see their endowments at risk.
Mike, what can you say will be the result of these specific NSF types of grant cuts, short-term and long-term?
I think in the short term, you're chilling a bunch of scientists. You're preventing the current generation of students from being able to learn. We're stopping our ability to learn things that are directly applicable to problems that are happening right now in the country. And I think long term, so many projects that have been cut were multi-year projects. And so even if the NSF changed his mind, but it's not really the NSF, even if the president changed his mind tomorrow and said, let's give it all back, projects have stopped. Clinical trials have stopped. If medical trials have stopped giving people a drug because they no longer have grant funding to do it, we can't know if it worked. And we can't just start again because we decided we were foolish to dump the grant in the first place. And so we've set ourselves back years, even if we immediately change course and try to go back to what we were doing 6 weeks ago.
And we're only 100 plus days into these kinds of cuts. In just a minute or so we have left, on these topics on this program, I keep asking people like yourself, you know, how can this happen? But I've changed that question over these last couple, 3 or 4 months to how can this unhappen?
Well, I think that it really is up to scientists and students and universities to try and communicate the value of what they do with some urgency and also some humility. And I think it's up to people to pressure their lawmakers to say, we don't like that these clinical trials for cancer are stopping in our state. We don't like that the VA has a hiring freeze and can't hire students to work on projects. And those students need to be in those labs to be competitive for medical school. Like, there's all kinds of ripple effects that are happening. And until there's a coordinated effort to share with our leaders that we don't like this, it's not going to stop.
Mike Wagner, thank you for joining us again on the Friday Buzz. I hope you have a good weekend.
You too. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, you're so welcome. Mike Wagner is the director of the Center for Communication and Civic Renewal and the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communications. All right. Coming up in the second half hour, of the Friday Buzz music, announcements, Uncruise Picks, and a visit with Madison's newest bookstore pop-up owners, the black and trans-owned Baldwin Books and Records. And then between 8:45 and 8:50, we have scheduled an interview, speaking of the topics that we just covered with Professor Wagner. We have a scheduled interview, a ward-exclusive interview scheduled with U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. You're listening to WRT-FM 89.9 in Madison, Wisconsin. It's 8:31.
Ghost Rider, motorcycle hero. Baby, 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 he's a-looking so cute. Sneaking round and round, round in a blue jumpsuit. Ghost Rider, motorcycle hero. Baby, 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 he's a-blazing away. Like the stars, stars, stars in the universe. Ghost Rider, motorcycle hero.
Hi, this is Casey Fox, host of Guilty Pleasures, every Wednesday night, 8 to 11 p.m. here on WORT. The Milwaukee Film Festival started April 24th and runs for 2 weeks. On my show, April 30th, I'll be featuring oodles of interviews with producers and directors of films coming up at the Oriental and Downer Theaters in the Lower East Side of Milwaukee. It'd be great to have you tuned in to find a movie right in your wheelhouse that you can maybe take your friends and or relatives to make a day of it in Milwaukee. So please tune in Wednesday, April 30th, 8 to 11 p.m. as I highlight week 2 of the Milwaukee Film Festival.
Support for this program comes from WORT's listener sponsors and Isthmus Newspaper. Isthmus is back on newsstands the first Thursday of every month, and now a nonprofit. Isthmus continues to expand its independent coverage of local government, the arts, and all things Madison at isthmus.com.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Blue Stem Jazz, presenting the Jimmy Ferrace Quartet at the North Street Cabaret on Friday, April 25th at 8 p.m. Jimmy Ferrace's recent debut album, Hours Fly, Flowers Die, is a heartfelt narrative with themes of nostalgia and the passage of time. More information and tickets are available at bluestemjazz.org.
It's the Friday 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Andy Moore. Yeah, I know you're busy. You got crap to do. You're in good hands because you haven't made plans for your weekend and live music this week, and we're here to help you. I shouldn't say we. I shouldn't take any credit for that at all. It's due to the hard work and research and professionalism of Ankur Malhotra, who will now give us Ankur's Picks. But first, here's Jim Wilson with the Ankur's Picks disclaimer.
Ankur's Picks are not influenced by any outside entities. Ankur consults with an advisory board of one, Ankur Malhotra. The cost of admission to any recommended show is of no concern to Ankur, nor the price of beer, nor the cleanliness of the venue restrooms. Ankur has one goal and one goal only in the delivery of Ankur's Picks, for you to have a kick-ass musical experience. Ankur's Picks is a trademark of the multinational corporation DJ Spin Cycle. All copy and trade therein is solely possessed. Here's Ankur Malhotra.
Good morning, Madison. I'm going to start with my rant.
Go for it, Ankur.
Well, all things are not made in factories, such as human capital, intellect, art. These are borderless, boundless. And it has never been a playing field for international musicians coming to play in the U.S. to share their art, their music, their culture. And that is the case with, you know, just to give you an example, say a trio had to come and play in the U.S., it might cost up to $7,500 just in visas and processing fee to make that happen. A trio from the US, if they had to go and play in, say, India, that'd be, you know, maybe $300-$400 in total for the trio. So, and yeah, or they could go for free, you know, no visas needed for them to play in Europe. So it's never been a playing field. So next time there's an international band coming out there, go out and support them. But if even if they're not coming out there, get out there and find out why and call your congresspeople to let them know things have to change. And that's the case again. So Livia Matos, a Brazilian trio, award-winning, you know, showcasing at Womex and all over the world, still waiting for her visas, more than, you know, 3 weeks into the guaranteed government response time. And so, yeah, there was a show that was supposed to happen tonight at the Gamma Ray Bar, and that's not going to happen, but instead, I'm going to take on to the decks and spin for 3 hours. And Kevin at Gamma Ray and I, we've decided that we're going to raise money and donate it to Immigration Law Group that's working to bring in international acts, artists into the United States. And then tonight at Stoughton Opera House, Keller Williams. At Cafe Coda tonight, Tani Diakate and the Afro Funk Stars. And tomorrow at Cafe Coda, Aaron Luthra and the Konakol Project. That's it for music this week.
Folks. Thank you. Thank you so much, Encore. And we will be back in about 30 seconds to talk with the owners of Baldwin's Books and Records. Friday at O'Clock Buzz, I'm Andy Moore, segment two. They call it a, quote, small piece of the resistance pie, unquote. They are Micah Robinson and Lily Sumson. The It is Baldwin's Books and Records, Madison's first black and trans-owned pop-up bookstore. And although it just got started, already it's roaring along, popping up at events all over town. Micah Robinson and Lily Sumson join us now in the studio, and good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
This is kind of a nutty way to start our conversation, but I looked at photos of one of your pop-ups. I think it was at the Garver property recently, and I couldn't help but notice how warm and inviting your actual space is, even though it's portable. But even though it's portable, it's like you're welcoming readers and listeners into your very own living room. Micah, I'm sure that's intentional, is it not?
Yes, absolutely. And thank you so much. That means so much to us. We have spent a lot of time like coordinating, trying to figure out the exact way we wanted things to look. So.
And that's not a small feat, because it's a small footprint. And to make it that warm and inviting, I mean, I wanted to dive through the screen and, you know, rifle through the records, you know, sitting on my couch. It's very, very well done. Lily, your slice of the resistance pie are books and titles that are important to read in any era, but are titles that are, and literally is a word I've tried to extract from my vocabulary, because things are either they are or they're not, but there's no way around it here. You're selling titles that are literally outlawed by the Trump administration. Tell us some examples, and you brought some, just a couple, two or three examples of what we can find in your inventory.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have brought a few books. It was so hard to choose.
Oh, I bet. Yeah.
But we brought Fun Home by Alison Bechdel. We have The Other Black Girl by Sakaya Delilah Harris. I Got Thunder, Black Women Songwriters and Their Craft. Yeah. And then we have this amazing anthology of refugee people who are from Minnesota. So this is called Somewhere in the Unknown World by Kao Kalia Yang.
It's so cool because it's a mixture, obviously, of fiction and nonfiction. I may buy this from you, the one you just handed me before you leave. And this looks, it's Fun Home, it's a family tragic comic novel, a National Book Critics Circle Award finalist. And that's a nice price. I'm not supposed to talk about money on this
but
nonprofit.
You can.
Micah, you brought some record albums that came from your band. What'd you bring?
Yes. So we have Diana Ross's self-titled. Gets played a lot in our house. Helado Negro's Private Energy. Katie Lang. This is absolute torch and twang.
I'm a country person.
Yeah.
Katie Lang is a real butt kicker.
Yes. Yeah. So we've got her, and then we've got Joan Armatrading. Oh, so kind of in that same.
It's fantastic.
Folksy vein. But
Fantastic. Now, Micah, it was staying with you. You have an unusual, and it seems to me, rather labor-intensive way to gain inventory. Mm. Talk about that.
Yeah, so I think first it starts with research. So we kind of scour the internet looking for, like, library sales or estate sales, anything that's happening in Madison or within, like, a 50-mile radius, just about. And we take our little Honda Fit and we go to these library sales and, pick them up just from there. And that enables us to kind of, like, keep prices lower while also, like, getting inventory that we really love and would love to see in a bookstore ourselves at, like, a good use condition.
It sounds like a rescue mission of sorts. Lily, you're, as I understand it, hearing a little bit from teachers and librarians about titles that are unfortunately in a question. Is that so?
Yes, absolutely. So we have seen a huge influx of things on Facebook Marketplace and even on UW Swap. I've gotten some books where these teachers are like, I don't have any use for my Black History Month section, or I don't have any use for these 50 books that have like fed my classroom for however many years. And we were seeing that, and we were trying to see a silver lining in it, thinking about how we can rescue these books and still keep them within the community so that they're not liquidated or destroyed by the Trump administration. So
maybe we'll see a day when those schools are your customers.
Exactly.
And maybe it'll come back. Yeah. But once you obtain these beautiful titles, and I'm thinking now more specifically about books than LPs, you freshen the books up and rehab them. How does one rehabilitate an old book that still needs reading, Micah?
So lots of them, especially from library sales, have like the plastic covers on them or like, you know, a bunch of different stickers. So it's a lot of Goo Gone and elbow grease. And that's kind of our secret.
Yeah.
If you're just hopping in, we're talking with Micah Robinson and Lily Sumson, the Black and trans owners of Baldwin's Books and Records pop-up store. Lily, James Baldwin certainly fits on the shelf of your pop-up, but tell us how he became the namesake of the store.
Yeah, so we were really going through a few different authors because we were thinking about who to name this bookstore after. We wanted to be in conversation, in lineage with other authors that we feel like we're doing the same thing or are doing a similar thing that we are. And it feels like James Baldwin was such a wonderful choice, like thinking about his Blackness, his queerness, and how he really stood up to the administrations that he was under. He really felt like an ancestor to call to. So that's why we're Baldwin's Books and Records.
And there's a beautiful alliteration, if I'm using that word right.
Yeah.
Is it Baldwin's Books, the BB, or is that correct? Did
I use the
word
BB,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. Micah, this is going to sound a little bit obvious, but how can libraries and books be an important refuge for people?
I mean, I think from my own personal experience, I grew up in a very conservative part of Michigan, and as like a little queer kid, wanting to see people like me reflected in literature and media, libraries quite literally saved my life. So I think I've heard that from folks of that being like a reflected experience, especially in the queer community.
Mm. Lily, how have books been a powerful resource for you?
Well, I recently just graduated with my MFA in poetry. So I feel like books and poetry specifically has been so close to me. But I think that for me, I grew up in Gary, Indiana. And so the library, like Micah, was such a refuge for me. And being able to give that back to people has been really amazing as well. Like, we have a few people who have come to our pop-ups who will just read titles until they start to cry. And then they're like, oh my gosh, okay, I'm crying.
Just reading the titles.
Yeah, they're like, okay, this is the one for me. And I was like,
oh my goodness.
Like, to see that what? People are really moved by yes. what we're doing and that they're excited about it. Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever heard someone describe a bookstore reaction in that way.
Yes.
Just on the titles.
Yeah.
You both have a poetry background, if I understand mm-hmm. it. If I'm correct, you met studying in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And then you lived and worked in Nashville. Not to bore you with your own timeline, if I have all this correctly. Mm-hmm. And now you're involved in graduate studies and university work at UW-Madison.
Mm-hmm.
When did you move up here from Nashville?
So about a year and a half ago.
Oh, it's been a while.
Yeah, yeah. So it's
then
been
I guess
a while.
This is a fair question, and don't dress it up, Micah. I'm going to start with you. What do you like about Madison?
I mean, we're both Midwesterners at heart, so returning back to the Midwest has been such a lovely experience. And I mean, the lakes here are like that's the obvious answer, but just biking along the lakes, especially at this time of year, is like. It makes me feel alive. And
that's great.
Yeah.
Lily, you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, being from Chicago, when we moved to Madison, we were like, oh, we're for sure going to just go back to Chicago after your program, and then
okay.
that's it.
So the Midwest was on your radar.
Yeah, totally. But then when we came here, we were like, oh, we want to stay here. Like, Madison has really had such a spot in our hearts,
well,
and so it's been so great to be
I'm
here.
I'm so glad you found a way. Real quickly here in the just 30 seconds or so we have left, I have two really like lightning round questions for you. Okay. So I just wasted 3 seconds. Where and when is Baldwin's next pop-up?
So we are going to be at the Big Gay Market, June 14th.
Yeah, that sounds right.
And where is that?
So that's going to be
the Alliance Center.
Yeah, the Alliance Center. Yeah.
Okay, and you have an Instagram presence as well, correct?
Yes.
At Baldwin's Books and Records, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's Baldwin's Books, yeah.
Finally, last question. This is the same question for each of you, Micah, starting with you. What are you reading right now?
I mean, lots of it has been coursework. I'm finishing up graduate studies, so that's been a big part of that.
For pleasure.
I mean, we have Fun Home sitting right here. I feel like that is one that I return to often, and graphic novels. And
how am I going to buy this now?
We've got other copies.
It's for you.
Okay.
It's for you.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. And Lily, what are you reading?
Yeah, I'm reading Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer.
Micah Robinson and Lily Sompson, thank you for joining us on the Friday Buzz, and best of luck with the store.
Thank you.
So much.
You're welcome. Micah Robinson and Lily Sompson, the Black and trans owners of Baldwin's Books and Records pop-up store. Okay, coming up next on the Buzz, if we can wrangle, if this is still looking good, I got a thumbs up. Energy going on in the studio right now. We'll have an interview with the U.S. Secretary of Health, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. This is WRTFM in Madison, Wisconsin. It's 8:49. It's the Friday 8 o'clock Buzz. I'm Andy Moore. After a predictably controversial and abbreviated run for president last year, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was chosen by the Trump administration as the country's health secretary. In his first 100-plus days on the job, he's taken on everything from food coloring to autism to antidepressants to fluoride in the water.
And of course, he's created and fed new skepticism among Americans on the topic of vaccines. And all that's just skimming the surface. We climb into some of these topics now. With Jim, do we have the secretary latched?
We do.
Okay, thank you. Joining us now by phone from Washington, D.C., U.S. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. Secretary Kennedy, good morning to you. And thank you very much for making time.
Good morning. Good morning, Andy.
I'm sorry if you found my introduction a little harsh.
Oh, no, it was a good introduction, Andy.
Thank you. Fair enough. A general question first, and it speaks to the panoply of issues that you focused on, that we touched on these last 4 months. Fast forward 3+ years. If there's only one thing you can accomplish for the health of Americans, what would it be?
Three years is a long time, Andy. I would hope for every American to embrace skepticism. Skepticism toward vaccines,
skepticism,
research, science, history, and a number of other, you know, subject areas. The one area I think skepticism is not appropriate is toward the president and this administration. I think the evidence is clear that every policy, every word that comes out of this administration and this president is trustworthy and beyond reproach.
You make skepticism sound like that it is its own scientific fact.
I believe strongly in skepticism. For example, I'm skeptical that we're speaking right now, that we live in a reality.
I assure you, we are speaking. But let's roll into something specific. Earlier this week, you spoke about your concern over teenage sperm counts, and you said an American teenager today has less testosterone than a 68-year-old man. And you said that sperm counts are down 50%. A couple of things on this. Why are 68-year-old men your example?
I don't remember saying that, Andy, but let's accept for a moment the reality that I said it. This was from a study, a series of studies that came out years ago. I took notice. As you know, Andy, the genitals of our nation's teenagers are a major priority of this administration. The 68-year-old was a random number that has nothing to do with the fact that I was 68 when I first heard about the finding and have been repeating it. Sperm count matters because we need women to give birth and you need sperm to do that. I'm working closely with Vice President Vance on this. We're working on some exciting ideas involving birthing farms. Also, I'm working with officials to create a sperm count registry. The president supports the idea. He likes the general concept of registries overall. We're going to create a special department, a lot like ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, that will go out and count the sperm of every young boy in the country. We're calling it the Sperm Squadron. It's going to be a major effort.
Pretty ambitious. But Secretary Kennedy, all that aside, why does a person's sperm count matter to anyone but the person whose sperm is getting counted?
Well, to answer that, Andy, I would say that I mentioned skepticism earlier. We don't want to express any skepticism toward the things that I say. What I've said is based on the most current observable evidence. For example, I put that bear in Central Park to make it look like it got hit by a bike. I couldn't keep it in my car. I had to go to the airport. I think Americans are clear on that.
Did you really tie a whale head to the hood of your car like 20 years ago?
I did. There's nothing mysterious about that. And it's been well reported on. I used a chainsaw to cut the head off of the whale and took it home, strapped it to the hood of my car. I know a lot of people complained that whale juice was splattering on their cars on the highway, but I enjoy studying the bones and skulls of particularly large mammals. I wish I'd been able to take the bear carcass home, as I said, but I needed to get to the airport.
Secretary Kennedy, earlier this month, you made some heavy comments about autism. You said young people with autism will never pay taxes or hold jobs. You said autism destroys families. What are you basing this on?
I'm basing these comments on the latest findings. You can look it up. Science, you know, is one way that we get information, but, you know, we can also get good information from horse sense, common sense. That's where I get a lot of my information. Also, horoscopes, tarot cards. There are a number of different sources that we can access. And the internet, podcasts, what they're calling now a broadcast. Excellent source of information, scientific information.
Okay. What? And now you said back to the topic of registries. You talked about the sperm registry you're developing. You also this week announced an autism registry. Why is that needed? How's that going to work?
In case you know we ever need to set up camps, I think it's important to at least put the names on a list. You can't put people in a special area without a list. I think history teaches us that much, Andy.
Did you say set up camp?
If we were to create a special summer camp people with autism, I think it could be a lot of fun.
I got it.
I think we're working with that. We're working on that with again immigration.
Yeah.
Custom of enforcement.
Okay. Secretary Kennedy, at one point...
They've explained to me that they're big on camps.
Okay. At one point in your life, you said that there was a worm living in your brain. Do I have that right? What was that about?
Oh, no, that's totally false, Andy. The worm was not in my brain at one point. It's still there. I tried to get it
okay.
removed surgically with the same chainsaw that I had used on the whale. We don't have a lot of evidence, Andy, about brain worms.
Yeah.
The most up-to-date source of science we have on brain worms is from the movie Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, which I've studied carefully.
We just have a couple minutes left, even though I'd like to do a follow-up question on that. Real quickly, let's set the record straight on vaccines. Do you or don't you recommend that all American families have their children vaccinated for measles?
Well, I think we've seen a lot of troubling evidence come out of the blogosphere and out of we're looking at evidence from space. We're getting beams from outer space, religious divine messages that have been sent that are giving us new evidence that we're compiling carefully to compare with the science. And so don't get vaccinated is the basic message.
We just have less than 30 seconds, but this is impossible not to ask the Secretary of Health. Could you tell us what your morning routine is that casts you off in a good, healthy direction each day?
Oh, I'd be happy to. I do my elevated inverted push-ups. I do a plank where I hold myself sideways horizontally while not holding on to any bar. You can see I've got the core strength, and I work on that, and I do it by, Andy, I eat nothing but parsnips. That's the only thing I will ingest, and occasionally I'll drink parsnip juice, but if you only eat parsnips in the morning and you do your calisthenics, you can levitate.
Okay.
And I'll teach everyone. Okay. I'll be holding a press conference to explain to Americans how they can levitate.
Right.
But
you've got
to avoid the food dyes.
Yep.
They won't work if you dye the parsnips. I've tried it, Andy. If they're blue, it doesn't work.
Duly noted. Secretary Kennedy, I'm sorry we're out of time. In fact, we're going a little over our allotted time, but it was well worth it. You're a very busy, busy person. Thank you for joining us on the Friday Buzz.
Thank you for having me, Andy.
You're welcome. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is U.S. Secretary of Health. He was played by the founding and longtime editor of The Onion, Scott Dickers. You can get creativity, productivity, inspiration, and tips on being funny every day on his Substack, Stop Dickering Around. Scott's latest book is The Elements of Humor. That's all, folks. We're about 40 seconds over. For Elliot and for Jim and for Ankur, I'm Andy Moore. Have a great damn weekend. Aloha. Come on now.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Friday, April 25th.
Over the millennia, farmers everywhere have learned the wisdom of a common sense practice in agriculture. Don't eat your seed corn. Raise the best crop you can, but be sure to store enough of the seed you produce this year to plant next year's crop. Even with a razzle-dazzle computerization of modern-day agriculture, seed savers are as essential as ever. Maybe more so, given climate change, mass pollution, species collapses, genetic loss, etc. Seeds are our future. Luckily, a local, national, and global